Cause number 1321335CB, Anadarko Petroleum Corporation versus Glenn Hagar, Comptroller of Public Accounts of the State of Texas, and Ken Paxton, Attorney General of the State of Texas.
May it please the court. The greater the risk, the greater the reward, and the higher the potential for loss. The oil and gas industry is the archetype for the risk-reward trade-off. For over 100 years, Texas has shared in those risks and been rewarded with great prosperity, in part because our legislature has wisely chosen to acknowledge the realities of the industry and to share in the risks through tax preferences found in Chapter 171 of the Texas Tax Code. Spoilage, abandonment, reclamation, rework labor, scrap, intangible drilling and dry hole costs are all costs that are expressly allowed to be subtracted under the cost of goods sold statute found at 171.1012 of the Texas Tax Code. And all of those costs only arise when unsuccessful production occurs. The cost at issue in this case arose from the unsuccessful production of oil from the Macondo oil well in 2010. Anadarko is entitled to subtract its cost for three reasons. First, all of our costs qualify as either the direct cost incurred in connection with the production of our goods, or as the indirect cost that we incurred in relation to our goods. Second, all of our costs, when viewed in light of the economic realities test, can only be viewed as cost of unsuccessful production. And unsuccessful production costs, as we'll see when we look at the statute, are all subtractable costs under 171.1012. And third, when you review our costs on a cost-by-cost basis, they each independently qualify as either a direct cost of goods sold or indirect cost. So turning to my first point, that all
Let me ask one quick question, though, before you proceed, Ms. Leonard. As you're well aware, Appley is saying that these are disaster response costs as opposed to the arguments that you are making. And in your brief, you state that they have changed their argument on appeal. I'll confess I have not delved into the record of this case yet. Was the disaster response argument made to the trial court?
No, Your Honor. Their primary focus was that this was a settlement cost, and by virtue of being a settlement, somehow we wouldn't get those costs. Now, of course, they did state, and we all acknowledge that it was a disaster, but that was not their focus. The focus was on the fact that it was that the payment was made via settlement.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so turning back to our first contention, that all of our costs are either direct costs or indirect costs. I'm going to take first the direct cost. So 171.1012C says that as a producer of an owner of goods, we're entitled to claim all direct costs of producing our goods, including specifically intangible drilling and dry hole costs, which can be found at subsection C7. Intangible drilling and dry hole costs is a technical term of art used only in the oil and gas industry. It has no meaning outside of that context. And we know under the Code Construction Act that we have to give technical terms such as this their industry meaning. The industry finds that uses the term intangible drilling cost to mean any cost incurred in relation to drilling that doesn't result in something tangible that has salvage value after you incur the cost. So things like wages, fuel, surveying, the industry, the only evidence in the record to this effect, it comes from testimony from our witnesses and whom the comptroller did not challenge with respect to whether this was an accurate definition. In fact, they don't offer a definition of what this means. Here, it's clear that all of our costs would fall into intangible drilling and dry hole costs. It's also important to note that at the audit level, our auditor allowed the exact same types of costs that we're trying to deduct here with respect to all of our other wells under the same categories that we've grouped them here.
And what is the reason that's being given for the different treatment?
Here, Your Honor, the only reason they're giving is that because the costs were incurred in relation to, you know, unsuccessful production, which they'll call a disaster, that in and of itself is enough to lift us out of the tax code, take us away from 171.1012, and, you know, erase the statute.
But isn't unsuccessful production a common thing in this industry? I mean, I don't know much about the oil industry, I'll confess, but I would think waste and unsuccessful production happens even apart from a disaster like we had here.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And that's why those costs were allowed with respect to all of the other wells. You know, there's testimony in the record that with respect to every well, there's going to be some spilled oil, some waste that occurs. It's just waste is a inescapable byproduct of the production of oil and production of goods in general.
Counsel, at what point would ocean and shore cleanup efforts no longer be considered repair of real property subject to subtraction under the statute?
I don't think, Your Honor, that there is a, you know, I would say that if you're looking at it from a time perspective, you know, as long as the effort is ongoing and still tied to, you know, your good that you were producing in a particular tax year, you would continue to be able to subtract those costs. You know, if there was a separation in time where, you know, you discontinued efforts and then tried to do something much later, perhaps that would be a line you could draw. But as long as it's a continuing, ongoing effort, the statute clearly allows you to subtract those costs. So turning back to our first argument and why these are direct cost of production, you pointed out that they've used the term disaster. And disaster here is not, we don't believe is helpful to the court, because disaster, as you said, really just denotes that you've had unsuccessful production occur on a large scale. There's nothing in the in 171.1012C, which is where we find direct costs, that limits the scale of your direct costs. Instead, the statute says all direct costs are entitled to be subtracted. And because we clearly have shown that we have direct costs in the form of intangible drilling and dry hole cost, we're entitled to subtract all of those costs.
Is the difference here that there was a blowout, or can you have unsuccessful production without a blowout?
Yes, you could definitely have unsuccessful production without a blowout. I mean, there's all waste would be considered unsuccessful production, and you're going to have waste 100% of the time. Okay. So turning to our second part of our first argument that we also qualify as indirect costs under 171.1012 subsection D. Here, with respect to indirect costs, these are just costs that you incur in relation to the goods. Production is not a requirement like it is under subsection C, so it's broader. And we've specifically pled subsections D3 and D5. D3 is where you find that list where the legislature expressly acknowledges that unsuccessful production can occur, and then you're going to have to deal with the results of that, where they say you're entitled to subtract costs related to spoilage, abandonment, reclamation, rework labor, scrap. You know, with respect to abandonment and reclamation, again, these are terms of art only seen in the oil and gas industry, or particularly with reclamation. This is the cleaning up and reclaiming of the environment and returning the oil well site back to the way that it was prior to you being there. And then, of course, abandoning is where they cap the well and go away from it. But what's important to note here is under what we call OSCLA, the Outer Continental Shelf Land Act, you cannot get a lease clearance certificate from the federal government to sell your lease or continue to operating, whatever you need to do, unless you reclaim the environment. And there's extensive testimony in the record that from David Bump that this has to be done in order to sell a lease. And in addition to being an owner of oil and producer of oil, Anadarko also buys and sells leases. And in order for this lease here in connection with the Macondo well to have any value, we had to reclaim that environment and clean up the drilling site before we could move on. And we had to, also required there is we had to abandon the well properly. All of those things had to be done and those costs incurred. And the legislature clearly understands this as a reality of the oil and gas industry and included those preferences because they want to incentivize oil and gas companies to continue to take the big risks. Okay. So we've also pled D5, which is a very broad category of post-production cost in relation to the property. So here you see the legislature going even further and acknowledging that you may have something that started out as a good, but because your production is unsuccessful, it's no longer a sellable good. But it's still your property and you still have to deal with it. And you still ran into these troubles while you were engaged in production in the ordinary course of business, right? No matter how bad the bad things go wrong, that is still what you were engaged in at the time that, the incident occurred and the cost ultimately spring forth from that. And we believe all of our costs qualify also as post-production costs in relation to our property. Tied to each of our three goods. Okay. So turning to our second point, second contention, that even when you apply the economic realities test to this situation, Anadarko's costs still qualify to be deducted. In the state's view, when you apply the economic reality test, you throw out the statute. And that's just not correct. The economic reality test is simply a lens through which you view the statute. And when you view the statute here, it's clear from the language the legislature used that they intended to allow, producers and owners of goods to subtract cost in relation to unsuccessful production. By virtue of saying, intangible drilling and dry hole cost, that's the ultimate in unsuccessful production, right? Is a dry hole. And they expressly allow that in 1012C.
How do you respond to the argument, though, with that is being made by Applee regarding the proximity? The proximity to production does not make the response a direct cost.
So the proximity argument, Your Honor, comes from the Gulf Copper case, which our firm handled the trial of. There, what the court said was that Gulf Copper, who is a drilling rig recoding and repairing service, they were recoding and repairing these rigs there in Corpus Christi, and the rigs weren't necessarily involved in an ongoing drilling project at the time, yet they were trying to say that they qualified as an owner of goods because they were providing labor and materials to a drilling project. And the court said, you can't say that just because someday that rig may end up on an ongoing project, that at the time you're providing your repair services to a rig that's not yet assigned, that you qualify as an owner of goods. We don't have that here. We're clearly smack dab in the middle of an ongoing project when these costs arrive, and an ongoing project that we're trying to wrap up and return to set to rights. But and that's with respect to all three of our goods, the oil, the leases, and the labor and material that we were providing to the drilling project to clean up our goods and reclaim the environment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So finally, I'd also like to say again that each of our costs qualify on an independent basis. We put the entirety of the billings that we received from British Petroleum in the record and a summary worksheet detailing each one of those. And there's, you know, no evidence that there was anything that these were not the bills that we received in relation to these costs, that they came from something else. And we've shown on a cost by cost basis that each one of these qualified. Your Honors, I see that my time is concluded. So if there's no other questions, Anadarko prays that you reverse the trial court decision, including.
Well, you still have your remaining 5 minutes. Don't forget.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Leonard. Mr. Smith.
May it please the court.
Yes, you may proceed.
May it please the court. The economic reality is that these costs were not costs of unsuccessful production. They were costs to pay the claims of persons damaged and injured by the spill. And what Anadarko received in return was indemnification, a release of all liability from BP for all liability arising from the Deepwater Horizon disaster. Second, the payment was the payments association with Anadarko's production does not make it a cost of goods sold. And third, Anadarko is essentially trying to take a federal deduction while applying the lower Texas franchise tax rate. So to characterize this payment, the court should be guided by the San Antonio Court of Appeals opinion in Owens Corning. There, a taxpayer argued that a payment into an asbestos trust fund was a cost of goods sold under subsection D9 of the statute as a cost of quality control. But the court held that this was not a cost of goods sold. And the court looked at what the payment was used for, and it was used to pay personal injury claims in pending and future asbestos product liability suits. And the court also looked at what Owens Corning was receiving from making this payment. And that was that it would be free of all pending and future asbestos product liability suits. And that's exactly what we have here with Anadarko. As I just mentioned, it made the payment to pay the claims of persons injured and damaged by this spill. And it received a release of all liability arising from the spill. So Anadarko.
But wasn't the money also paid for other things besides future settlements and funding of settlements?
Yes, absolutely, Justice Longoria.
What percentage was for settlements and what percentage was for other matters, do you know?
That is not immediately apparent from the face of the record, Your Honor. However, that is Anadarko's burden to separate out any costs that might actually be costs of production. As the taxpayer, as the plaintiff, it had the burden to separate out the cost, and Anadarko did not attempt to do that. But even if we look at the costs, Your Honor, these were not production costs. The Coast Guard was actively responding to this disaster and billing British Petroleum for many of these costs, and then British Petroleum was turning around and billing Anadarko. So the Coast Guard is not a producer of oil. And so those costs are certainly not production costs. These were costs of firefighting on the rig. 11 people died there. It was decontamination of the oil. A very large portion, as Anadarko points out in its brief, was to pay commercial losses from businesses as a result of this disaster. And then, of course, there were also the natural resource damage payments to all of the Gulf states. So to the extent as I said, to the extent there may have been some costs that might have been of a kind with costs that are actually production costs, Anadarko has not even attempted to separate out those costs.
Council, can you provide us a scenario where costs could be characterized as both a disaster response and production costs?
So Anadarko has mentioned that it recovered oil during this disaster response. And the cost directly associated with that recovery of oil could be a production cost, because you're simultaneously cleaning up the oil and recovering it. However, Anadarko,
that being that appellant was entitled to some subtraction.
Appellant could have been, Your Honor, but appellant has not attempted to put a number on that amount, and it was appellant's burden as the plaintiff to do that. Appellant has taken an all or nothing approach, and that is probably because there are not enough production costs to make the subtraction worthwhile. If in fact appellant did separate out the production costs.
And so would that be the reason then your treatment of them is different, as appellant argued you have allowed subtraction of these categories of costs at 100% with other wells, like containment, cleanup and restoration, damages to state and businesses. You would have allowed them before, but you're not doing so in this case because they have not been split out. Is that right?
Precisely, Your Honor. Again, they probably represent a very, very small portion of the cost as well. And that's probably why appellant did not separate them out to begin with. And I'd also like to make the point that just because the costs are associated with production, that does not make them cost of goods sold under the statute. The Texas Supreme Court in Gulf Copper was very clear that just because the taxpayer produced oil and engaged in some production activities, that did not mean that the costs qualified as costs of production. And Owens Corning is also a great example of this. These were product liability payments that the taxpayer made that related to the products that the taxpayer had produced. And yet the court held that because the payment did not relate to the goods themselves, it was not a cost of goods sold. And the court also reiterated in that opinion that the general context of the subtraction, that is a cost for direct costs of production. And so subsection C specifically states that all of the costs contained within it must be direct costs of production. And so Anadarko is essentially attempting to turn the statute inside out. That is, jump straight to the specific costs listed, intangible drilling costs, dry hole costs, but it's jumping over the general requirement that they must be direct costs of production. And the Texas Supreme Court was quite emphatic about that in Gulf Copper. And then in subsection D, Anadarko is saying that this phrase in relation to means in relation to the costs. It does not mean in relation to the costs. It means in relation to the goods. And so all of those costs listed under subsection D must be costs as they relate to the goods. So abandonment of the goods or spoilage of the goods, and reclamation in particular, it needs to be reclaiming the oil. So that oil that Anadarko recovered, like I said before, the costs associated with recovering that oil would most likely be cost of goods sold. But that is only a small portion of all of these costs that BP billed to Anadarko. And again, this is within the context of a massive settlement, release of liability for Anadarko for all of the tort liability arising from this disaster. The dispute between Anadarko and BP regarding the joint interest billings had to do with whether Anadarko had to pay them at all, because Anadarko alleged that BP had been not just negligent, but grossly negligent in causing this spill. And under the contract between the two, gross negligence on BP's part would release Anadarko from any obligation to pay any costs associated with this well. And so to talk about reclamation under D3, that is just recovering the oil. That is not reclaiming the Gulf of Mexico, its shores, that sort of thing, because those are not the good. And I'd just like to mention this argument that the Gulf of Mexico and its shores is the good was not preserved on appeal. It was not in appellant's brief. They raised it for the first time in their reply. And in any event, the Gulf of Mexico and its shores cannot be a good, because to be a good, the tangible personal property or real property must be sold in the ordinary course of a taxable entity. And that requirement is in subsection A1. And the Gulf of Mexico and its shores is not sold in the ordinary course of a taxable entity. Anadarko is trying to get around that and say that actually it can be considered to own the Gulf of Mexico and its shores, and that they can be treated as the good by using the third sentence of subsection I. And that states that a taxable entity that furnishes labor or materials to a real property project can be considered the owner of the goods. But this payment was made to pay the claims of persons damaged and injured by the spill. It was not made to furnish labor or materials to a real property project. So Anadarko simply does not fall within that third sentence of I.
And is in the settlement agreement that's in the record, we have some blurbs of it in the briefs, but does it go into all the detail as to precisely, as you're saying, what was being paid for, or is it very general?
So it says what the settlement agreement, yes, it does list all the things that were paid for, but it was literally all liability arising from the spill. So yes, the joint interest billings were involved, but there was this massive tort liability. There were over 3,000 lawsuits filed in federal court in the 5 years following the spill, with over 100,000 plaintiffs. And Anadarko, by making this payment, was essentially closing the door on any future liability arising from this. And so this very much has to do with massive tort liability.
Even though it was defined, the Deepwater Horizon incident was defined to include the containment efforts, the subsequent cleanup and remediation efforts. And then it says all other responsive actions. That's out of appellant's brief. But you're saying that the bulk of it was not for that. It was for liability claims.
Not exactly, Your Honor. The containment efforts are not necessarily cost of goods sold. The containment efforts, the cost of goods sold are only costs that are listed in the statute. And containment of a spill is not necessarily within the statute. We'd have to look at the specific costs of containment, and was it directly producing oil? So if you're simply containing oil and say you're burning it off, or you're just spraying dispersant on it or something like that, I'm not so sure that that's producing oil. Anadarko did actually recover some oil, but it would only get the cost of that actual recovery of the oil. And it did lose some oil. Some oil was spoiled, no doubt. But it would only get those specific costs of the spoiled oil. So containment is a bit too broad of a term to be able to put our finger on a cost within the statute. And same goes for reclamation, as I said before. So reclamation efforts, if it's not actually recovering the oil, if instead it's doing environmental remediation, reclamation, that is not what the statute covers, because the environment is not the good that's being sold here. That's the oil, or the court could also use the real property. But at the end of the day, it would need to be one or the other, either the oil and gas that was produced and then sold in the ordinary course, or the real property, which was bought and then improved and then sold in the ordinary course.
And according to appellant, 17% of the produced oil was captured and sold. So theoretically, the cost associated with that should be able to be subtracted as cost of goods sold, but they weren't segregated here. Is that what your argument is?
Not exactly. So not just any cost associated with it, but the direct costs of recovering it itself. And that, I think that distinction is really key, because essentially what Anadarko is trying to do is take any costs associated with production. When the Texas Supreme Court has said, no, it's not any cost associated with production, it's the specific direct costs that are under the statute. And perhaps something else that they may illustrate this is, in federal income tax law, taxpayers can generally deduct business expenses. And Anadarko was able to subtract this payment as part of its federal income taxes. But to compensate for that, the federal income tax has a higher tax rate. The Texas franchise tax allows far fewer subtractions, but then has a lower tax rate. And so essentially what Anadarko is trying to do is take advantage of both the subtractions allowed by federal law and the lower tax rate of the Texas franchise tax. And so it is very important to that the court be able to place this cost, this $4 billion payment, within the cost described by the statute, and to follow the requirements listed in subsection C generally and subsection D generally, as opposed to just jumping to the specific costs as Anadarko would have to do, and kind of inverting the statute and ignoring these general requirements that it contains. And to the point of production versus, say, tort type liability or any other costs that just aren't production costs, if a taxpayer purchased equipment to use in an oil and gas operation, that cost would be a cost of goods sold. But if a worker was injured by the equipment and then sued the oil producer, any damages or settlement resulting from that would not be a cost of goods sold. And so it doesn't have to do so much with the magnitude of this as the true character of the costs. And the economic reality is that Anadarko spend $38.5 million to drill this well to depth, but then made a $4 billion settlement payment in the aftermath of the spill. And that settlement payment is 100 times the amount that it cost Anadarko to produce or to drill the well, to produce the oil. So that by itself shows that the character of this payment was probably not for production. And this is probably why Anadarko is taking an all or nothing approach here, is because the actual costs of production are not enough to make a big enough dent in its tax liability to be worthwhile. And so for these reasons, because this was a payment to pay the claims of persons damaged and injured and release Anadarko from all liability arising from the spill, the comptroller and attorney general, as appellees, asked that the court affirm the trial court's judgment.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Ms. Leonard?
Yes, Your Honors. I'd like to start out with the fact that findings of fact and conclusions of law 26 and 28, all in some form or fashion, state that Anadarko did not pay the joint interest billings. And then conclusions of law 12, 14, 16, and 18, all state within them that we don't qualify for the cost to subtract the cost because we did not pay the JIBs. But when the state was asked in their argument whether or not the settlement agreement addressed the JIBs and resolved the JIBs, he answered, yes, the JIBs were involved. They were in fact resolved with the settlement agreement. On that basis alone, Your Honors, you have to reverse and remand this case. Because the fundamental fact that all of the conclusions of law rely on, that we did not pay these JIBs, has been conclusively shown to be incorrect in the record. The only evidence in the record is that the JIBs were paid and were resolved. The settlement agreement expressly addresses the JIBs and the costs and says that they were outright resolved with the settlement agreement the day immediately when it was signed. We no longer owe them. So I want to start there. The second thing I'd like to talk about is the idea of whether or not we ever expressly broke out the costs. In our opening brief, there is a chart that groups the costs into three broad categories: spill containment, natural resource damage claims, and then the third party damage claims. So we absolutely have grouped these costs in these categories, and we put that summary chart in our brief. We also, of course, again, have all of the joint interest billings in the record. We also have a summary worksheet where every single joint interest billing has been put into a single line on the worksheet that's in the record.
Was this done just for us on appeal, or was this done at the trial court below?
This was done in the trial court, and I can give you the record site. It's 12 RR 925 through 71. That's where you'll find the worksheet that can be manipulated. The JIBs themselves are at 11 RR 203 to 12 RR 863. So all of this information is in the record. So that is readily there and available, and it's and calculable which costs go to, you know, which grouping and what they would be. The next thing I would like to address is this argument that with respect to indirect, our costs qualifying as indirect costs under subsection D, that we're claiming that, you know, it just has to be in relation to the cost, not in relation to the goods. That is not what we're saying. What's happening here, we agree that the statute says you incur these costs in relation to the goods, but it does not say in relation to production of the goods the way subsection C does. Production is not in the preamble because this is a broader category. And what's happening here is the comptroller, under the guise of the economic reality test, is trying to add the word sellable before the word good, as if I had to have successful production of a sellable good and I can only claim cost and subtract cost that are in relation to a sellable good. And that's just not the case. I mean, clearly the legislature intended to allow producers of goods, owners and producers of goods, to subtract the costs of unsuccessful production. Finally, I'd also like to address the Owens Corning case, because earlier Justice Silva asked a question about, you know, timing and do the costs ever end? And I think that That question, when viewed under Owens Corning, is meaningful here, because the situation in Owens Corning was that you had a company who 50 years after they had produced a good were trying to deduct their costs as quality control costs. And what the court said there was that, you know, you can't subtract as quality control cost for a good you're producing in 2020, you know, a tort payment for a good that you produced 50 years ago. Those facts couldn't be further than what we have going on in our situation. We incurred our costs in the tax year at issue for which we're trying to subtract them. And we are not pleading that they are subtractable under subsection C9. We're pleading that they are direct costs under C7 or indirect costs generally or under D3 or D5. I see that my time is concluded. So in conclusion, Your Honors, Anadarko prays that you reverse the trial court's decision and render in its favor, or in the alternative, that you reverse and remand for recalculation.
Great. All right. Thank you very much. Very, very interesting case, interesting arguments, and good briefs. So we appreciate them very much. And the case will be under submission.